This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
Okay, so we cannot interpret Yoder simply as calling for a rejection of government. The Christian must share in God's providential patience with government, however tyrannical they may be. He must also hope for governments who will promote social harmony without committing gross injustices in the process. And Yoder should not even be understood as ruling out some degree of participation in government. So that in his book, The Christian Witness to the State, Yoder suggests involvement in the election process as an important means by which Christians can speak to those who are in authority. And he even construes refusal to vote, as in some when it's justified, as a way of making a positive witness to the state. It is even conceivable, Yoder says, that a legislator, if he has no concern for his re-election or for developing a power block, could, without compromise, conceive of his office as an occasion to speak to the authorities. So that if you go into politics using this as a platform for speaking to the authorities rather than as an agent of the government itself, Yoder could even approve of that. Okay, now I'm trying to be very careful that we portray his view just exactly for what it is. He's not rejecting all involvement in government. He's not rejecting government outright. Many Anabaptists in the past have spoken with that kind of excess. Yoder's not doing precisely that. We see an ambivalent attitude toward government in Yoder. Patience with government does not mean a lack of concern about government policy. He's not advocating quietism, withdrawal, or any of these things. However, our impatience with government cannot take the form of involvement because the political order operates in accordance with patterns incompatible with Christian discipleship. We cannot be agents of the government. To be an agent of the government, of course, is to use the very authority that Jesus condemned. Okay, within this framework, then, Yoder's argument with the Calvinistic or Reformed approach to the state has to do with far more than the question of pacifism or the legitimacy of war under certain circumstances. On the traditional Reformed view, as Yoder understands it, what is ordained is not a particular government, but the concept of proper government itself. The principle of government is ordained. The Reformed or Calvinist claims to possess criteria for distinguishing between proper and improper government. So, as Yoder says, quote, if a government fails adequately to fulfill the functions divinely assigned to it, it loses its authority. It then becomes the duty of the preacher to teach that this has become an unjust government worthy of rebellion. It can become the duty of Christian citizens to rise up against it, not because they are against government, but because they are in favor of proper government. Now, you have to understand, this is very true to history. It's usually in the Calvinist churches that the idea of just war and just revolution is discussed and preached. Karl Barth preached against the Lutherans who were submitting to Hitler's tyranny, because in terms of this Calvinistic heritage, it was the view that the state is subject to the norms of the Bible and that there is a proper time to rebel against the state. Now, over against this view, which assumes the legitimacy of the integral distinction between good governments which Christians should bless and bad ones against which they should rebel, Yoder insists that Christians should rather rebel against all and subordinate themselves to all, for subordination is itself the Christian form of rebellion. It is the way we share in God's patience with a system that we basically reject. Okay, I think this might be a good place to take a break. Okay, now let's try to be clear. Let's try to be clear as to where the difference is between Yoder and the Calvinist. Yoder is not denying that there is some kind of distinction to be made between proper and improper government. And he would agree with the Calvinist that the Christian is provided with a basis for offering an aggressive critique of specific policies of the government. The important points of disagreement are as follows. First, Yoder would reject the Calvinist's basis for deriving norms for distinguishing between proper and improper governmental activity. Secondly, he would reject as improper some items which the Calvinist would place within the proper domain of government activity. And third, he would dissent from Calvinist prescriptions concerning the motivation for and manner of political involvement. Okay, now let's hear some of the considerations that a Calvinist would want to introduce at this point in the discussion.
Well, you remember three points.
Yeah, 3 points. The Calvinist basis for deriving norms for distinguishing between proper and improper governmental activity. He would want to dispute some items that the Calvinist places within the proper domain of government. And third, he would dissent from certain prescriptions concerning the motivation for and manner of political involvement as the Calvinist sees it. Okay. Yoder rightly sees a theocratic ideal operating within the Calvinist tradition. Calvinists and Anabaptists would agree that Old Testament Israel and the New Testament Church are theocratic societies. The question is whether it is proper to attempt to bring contemporary societies in addition, that is, to the contemporary church, into some degree of conformity to theocratic ideals. Okay, now the Calvinists would want to immediately add that there were accommodations to sinful conditions that took place within the kind of theocratic framework developing after the fall in the nation of Israel. At the time of Samuel, with the shift from, if you will, a pure theocracy to one of administration by human kings, there is not an obliteration of the promise of divine blessing and guidance. Indeed, the king is viewed as a channel of divine blessing. However, there are problems that are going to operate in Israel as a result of the king as well. And so the theocracy is not, if you will, heaven on earth. It's recognized that there must be accommodations of human sin, and there will be the effects of sin. Okay. The Calvinist would want to say to Yoder that we find in the Old Testament that those who were operating within a theocratic context, those who were presupposing a theocratic basis of operation, often addressed pagan political situations and made use of their theocratic standards. And so the prophet Amos does not restrict his prophetic critique to Israel alone. Jeremiah counsels the Israelites to seek the welfare of the city where God has sent you into exile and to pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. Daniel admonishes Nebuchadnezzar to break off of your sins by practicing righteousness, and off of your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your tranquility. Now, in these Old Testament examples, there is, it seems, an extension, at least of some principles learned in the theocratic context, to a non-theocratic political situation. The same standards of justice can be applied even where the God of Israel is not acknowledged as the Lord. He is the Lord there, but he's not acknowledged as the Lord. Nevertheless, his standards of justice apply. In the New Testament, we see that the church was to make similar prayers for rulers and to engage in a similar critique of rulers. And consequently, the theocratic ideal, the Calvinists would say, is taught to us in the Bible. We should be taking theocratic ideals and using them as a model for non-theocratic society. Okay. Yoder would undoubtedly reply that in terms of the New Testament, we see a pattern of refusing to manage society, a refusal to promote righteousness backed by power, backed by the sword. And this is one of the high-level areas of rhetoric and critique between the Reformed and the Anabaptists, the idea that you are power-hungry, the other is pacifistic, and so forth and so on. Yoder says that we must not ask how we can cause good things to happen in politics, but rather how we can act in such a way that our actions witness to God's already having acted decisively in the cross of Jesus Christ. How we can act as those whose actions are the effect of the cross. We want to witness to the decisive act of God in the cross rather than asking how we can cause things to happen, how we can manage society, how we can back righteousness with power. Now I have difficulties, and I have the Reformed Christians' difficulties with this perspective. First, the refusal to, quote, run God's world for him, the refusal, quote, to manage society, is not necessarily a posture whose praiseworthiness is immediately obvious. The refusal to manage things would, it seems to me on the surface, seem to conflict with the command of God to have dominion over all of creation. Secondly, we certainly must warn against retreating to an attitude of skepticism. Calculation and prediction are crucial elements in our everyday experience, and they're especially important in our interpersonal and social maneuvering. No moral theory can ignore the crucial importance of prediction and calculation in trying to bring about results. And therefore, it isn't as though the Anabaptist wants to be a witness to what God has done, but the Calvinist is always calculating and trying to cause things to happen. Everybody's trying to cause things to happen. Everybody must engage in calculation. Everybody must engage in prediction and maneuvering of that sort. And those who don't risk, it seems to me, the unintelligibility of their social theory. Moreover, I would want to draw a distinction. Thirdly now, I'd like to draw a distinction between engaging in actions which have the effect of coercing other human beings to do such and such, and distinguishing between that, and then acting out of a desire to coerce others. The fact that the Calvinist believes that there are things we must do that amount to coercing other people does not mean that the Calvinist is motivated to do it because he likes to lord it over people. And that is often a distinction that is not drawn, and therefore I think there's some unfair polemics between Yoder and Calvinist from time to time. But fourthly, let's remember that the concepts of coercion, violence, and domination are not always easy to explicate. And so when Yoder has a generalized polemic against violence or domination or patterns of coercion, is it coercive to make your child eat his vegetables at the dinner table? You know, you have to start asking, at what point is coercion correct coercion and incorrect coercion? Furthermore, it's not clear to me that the Christian who refuses to act to curb political or economic oppression thereby escapes responsibility for coercion and domination. You see, refusing to act in our society is also a way of managing the affairs of others. Inaction very often becomes a brutal kind of action. So that if we're not doing something to clean up our political order, we may be propagating by our inactivity the very oppression that we're supposed to be witnessing against. I'm really going to have to get through this faster than I had anticipated. The last aspect of Yoder's critique of traditional Calvinist political stance is tied up with the idea of accepting powerlessness. Yoder looks at Christ's own submission to the state, to the wicked state, his own crucifixion, and how God brought victory out of that kind of subordinate attitude, that submissive attitude. And so he tells us that we must imitate the cross of Christ in our social theory. Well, first of all, this idea of imitating the cross of Christ in our social theory, the encounter with the forces of evil that we see in the cross of Christ seems to involve more than that which can be grasped by viewing the historical concreteness of the cross. We can legitimately ask to what degree we are to imitate certain aspects of suffering of Jesus in view of the fact that his sufferings have connections to events that we cannot duplicate, and in light of the fact that his suffering had theological significance that we ought not to imitate. And this idea of imitating the cross is fraught with problems as to the historical, empirical question of what Jesus was undergoing in that day, and theologically why he suffered and we ought not to suffer. If we see the cross of Christ, as Yoder does, as an encounter with the powers, these cosmic powers, these demonic powers, and we see that that's the way God conquers the powers through the cross, we mustn't forget that what Paul teaches in Colossians 2, is that Jesus nailed, you see, canceled the bond that stood against us to his cross that our sins might be forgiven. And then he took these powers captive its submission to the powers wasn't for the sake simply of being subordinate to them, but for the sake of ultimately dominating them. And now we have been forgiven. We don't need to go through the cross experience again ourselves. We live in that age of resurrection power where Jesus is dominating the powers. And so imitating the cross doesn't seem appropriate. We should be rather marching under the banner of the resurrection.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.